K2RW, KC2, QIQ.
And the answer is yes, Glenn, but left-handedly. When you go to amateurradio.tv, www.amateurradio.tv, and that's where you can look at all the past recordings for the technical net, you will also find a section there where the K2RIW impedance matching article is available to you. And then you will be looking directly, the article really comes in three sections. One section is the words of explanation, and the other two are the graphs. The graphs are the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Way back in 1948, you could say these guys, Brown and Woodward, with very primitive instrumentation, they didn't have any nice network analyzer where they could have done all this in a day. They put a man year with slotted lines and impedance measuring and whatever. They literally measured every possible ground plane, quarter wave, radial, so to speak, at every possible diameter and every possible length. They measured the exact resistive impedance and the reactive impedance. Let me drop. And the reason why they did that with a very large ground plane is that all dipoles are really two ground plane antennas back to back. So all those impedances you read off those curves, you just double the reactive impedance, double the resistive impedance, and now you know what a dipole is instead of a monopole. And so when you make the half-wave dipole a little bit longer than half-wave, you will find out from those curves the resistive component goes up slowly, but it goes up. The reactive component goes up rather rapidly. The combination of the two makes the impedance of the antenna considerably higher, so that your 70-ohm antenna could have a total impedance of 400 ohms very easily by stretching it that way. Unfortunately, a little bit of that is reactive, but since the 450-ohm line is so low in insertion loss, the fact that your load is a little bit reactive is a minor problem as I see it. So I think you've got a darn good solution there, Glenn. And as long as your antenna tuner, by way of your half-wave coax balun and the antenna tuner, can have enough tuning range at the shack end, you've got a very good arrangement. So although I haven't seen people do that exactly by way of the Brown and Woodward curves in my memory of them, because I'm now using them for the last 5 years, every day of my life, with the antennas that I'm designing to keep my the people I work with happy. What I'm getting at, let me drop. Those Brown and Woodward curves are a very good thing to memorize. If you're going to be feeding, if you're going to be building Yagi antennas where you're building driven elements, if you're going to be building dipole-like antennas, if you're going to be building quarter-wave ground plane antennas or five-wave ground plane antennas, if you study those diagrams, make a copy of them and tape them to the wall in your shack, so to speak, and sort of burn it into your brain, so that the next time you're in the on a South Sea island and you're alone and you've got nothing but a radio and some wire and you've got to make an antenna, and you remember what that curve looks like, you can now know exactly what to do to make it longer or shorter to get whatever reactive component and resistive component you want. And so that's what you did. I wonder, Glenn, how you made this discovery. Was this something that happened by accident, or was it an article you read? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
A little bit of both, Dick, and speaking to you in the past as well. What had happened was initially I had a balun that I had. It was pretty much a nice broadband balun that would work anywhere from 30 megahertz down to, about 1.4 megahertz, one that I built myself, but it was a 4-to-1. And I used to drive the ladder line out of the house from the balun. So the balun was mounted on a bulkhead, like a diamond plate, on the side of the house, and I would run the ladder line out to a loop antenna. And very, very good performance, nice broadband performance on the loop. But one day I was just experimenting with trying a dipole on there instead of the loop antenna to see what would happen. And I found out that by adjusting the length, I could get it close to a match, you know, a very, very nice match without any additional tuning, just by adjusting the length of the dipole right at the end of the open 450-ohm line right there. And when I went back and I was measuring it with the MFJ tuner to find out what kind of bandwidth and match I had, it was quite good, and it all depended on the length of the dipole. And what I found out was that when I was done, when I eventually left one up there for 20 meters, that it was about 5/8 of a wavelength. And not that there's necessarily something magic about 5/8 wave, but it was right about that on either side. And brought the line right in, and with a little bit of touch-up, you could even use it on a couple of different bands. But, of course, there you needed a tuner. But for a relatively just a 20-meter dipole, very, very amazing performance. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Well done, Glenn. That's the right way to do it. We're about to go over to the mailbag, but before I do, I'm going to feed in a couple of other comments here, and that is, we as amateurs are going to be building dipole-like antennas for the rest of our lives, 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, 17, 12, all of those meters of band, 6 meters. We're going to be building dipoles in the middle of particular Yagis. There are times when you want the dipole on a Yagi that the dipole-driven element might give you 20 ohms of impedance and you want it to be 50. Or a ordinary native dipole is 73 ohms and you want it to be, for whatever reason, you want it to be 35 ohms. The best kept secret in the world is that in order to readjust the impedance of your dipole, you don't have to do all these elaborate things like T-match, gamma match, folded dipole, delta match, all these funny things that people do with dipoles, and a fat radiator with a skinny feeder and so on, in order to find the right resistive component. Let me drop. No matter what your dipole is made out of, I don't care if you're building it out of 18-gauge skinny wire or a wide piece of copper strip tape or whatever, no matter what dipole you're building, whether it's fat or skinny, long or short or so on, the best-kept secret in the world is that the resistive component, the main component of its impedance, you have complete free adjustment continuously from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms inclusive. And what do? To do that? You just simply change the mechanical length of the dipole, which is really changing its electrical length at your particular frequency. As you make it short, the resistive component goes down, and you make it a little bit shorter than half wave, probably almost a quarter wave dipole, so to speak, and you're very close to 1 ohm of resistive component. Make it longer than half wave. As you start approaching full wave of length, the impedance goes to 1,500 ohms. So the resistive component, you can make it anything you want in a continuous manner, as if you were turning a potentiometer by just cutting the right length. If you're building out a copper tape, and if you were looking at the resistive component on a good network analyzer, and you got a pair of scissors in your hand, and you walk over to that copper tape, and you cut off a quarter of an inch, and you cut off an eighth of an inch, and you watch the resistive component come down, and you'll say, wow, I've got complete control of that. Let me drop. So by doing nothing but adjusting the length, looking at those Brown and Woodward curves, you'll know exactly what resistive components you're going to get as a function of length. That's the good news. There's one piece of bad news, and that is when each half of a dipole is not electronically a quarter wavelength long, or the whole thing half a wavelength long plus velocity factor, 0.95 times half wave. If it's anything longer or shorter than that, there's going to be a reactive component left over. That's not a showstopper. You know ahead of time that when you make it shorter, the reactive component is a capacitor, and you simply put the right size choke across the center of the dipole, the reactive component goes away. Or correspondingly, if you want the impedance, the resistive component to be high, and you make it a little bit longer than half wave, now there's going to be an inductive reactance left over. And you put a shunt capacitor across the center, and it goes away. So as long as you're willing to do the two-step process without going to fancy little mechanical procedures to get whatever impedance you want, just adjusting the length and be willing to put in a stray capacitor or an inductor in the right place, and the problem goes away. You've got complete adjustment, and each time I bring that to someone's attention, they say, gee, why hasn't someone told me that earlier? All you got to do is look at those curves that I'm talking about, the Brown and Woodward curves for a dipole, and which are on that website, and amateurradio.tv, and the information is all there if you know what you're looking at. Time for the mailbag. Go right ahead, Mel. And after that, some very good news came about from NASA this week, which we'll be hearing about. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY again, with my little harsh voice. Anyhow, hope you understand me. I must be sounding like I'm in a fog. Yeah, I got a number of emails, and some of them I have to say that what I have to do, or we have to do, is every so often, like I mentioned a little while ago, like with pin diodes, explain what the heck are we talking about. because this is a problem that few of the people mentioned, that we actually lose them on the first sentence. They said you should change the net from the TechNet to the Institute of Radio Engineers net. Without a degree in electrical engineering, they said you should tell them that beforehand, don't bother going any further. So we'll try to make it a little simpler at times, inject. I don't mean anything derogatory, but if I say, just give some simple answers, Dick, please bear with me. And I did get some comments on last week's discussion about FM, and a number of questions that were asked along with it sort of leads into the next thing called single sideband. So I thought if you'd like to, we could continue where we left off last week into discussion of SSB. Dick, over.
Very fine, Mel. The one good piece of news in the case of what we discussed tonight, yeah, we jumped right in and talked about PIN diodes without saying what it was, that it's an electronic switch, and PIN stands for positive, intrinsic, negative. The good news is that if a person heard us say the word PIN diode, and you Google the word PIN diode, you'll get a zillion articles on the subject telling you what it stands for, what it does, and why it's good. So the huge piece of information that's available to us these days, in other words, by way of that computer in your house and whatever search engine you like using, Google's probably the most famous one, but there's a lot of others. There's a tremendous amount of information available to you. There's a library sitting on your computer desk, if you know what I mean. Now, we did discuss last week, I tried to figure out how many people understand FM, and the answer is very few, even among the engineering world. What does that signal really look like? And I started off with AM first before jumping into FM. Let me drop. So I was mentioning the fact that if I was using a spectrum analyzer, this is one of these laboratory pieces of test equipment where it displays horizontally axis is frequency, low frequency, left-hand end of the dial, right-hand of the side of the screen, I should say, is high frequency. I could easily set up my spectrum analyzer so that it scans from 10 to 20 megacycles across the screen. And then vertically, it's telling me amplitude, and each vertical box could be 10 decibels of change in amplitude. That's a kind of a typical way of setting a spectrum analyzer. And if in this particular example, I was scanning from 10 to 20 megacycles, and I happen to have a carrier at 14 megacycles, which would be close to the center of the screen, and it's an unmodulated carrier. In other words, I've got a transmitter that's capable of transmitting Morse code. I press down the key and I put a brick on the key and I'm continuously transmitting a continuous signal of 14.1 megacycles with no modulation. On the spectrum analyzer screen, I would see a pure vertical line that would be on the screen at the position indicating 14.1 megs. And depending on how I set the gain control, I could make that vertical line go to near the top of the screen if I wanted to. Let me drop. Then in the simple example I gave is that I'm now going to build an amplitude modulator. I'm not going to tell you how I did it, but I'm going to take a single sine wave generator at 1 kilohertz as an example. I'm going to pour the 1 kilohertz sine wave. It could be my whistling if I've got a precise whistle out of my mouth. I'm whistling a 1 kilohertz pure tone into the microphone of this amplitude modulated transmitter. What I would see on that spectrum analyzer screen is a signal, the 14.1 megacycle carrier would be there. I would now start seeing an upper side lobe, upper side band, and a lower side band exactly 1 kilohertz away. So 14.101 would be the upper one, and 14.99 would be the 999, I think it would be the lower side band. 1 kilohertz away from the carrier, I'd see an upper side band and a lower side band because of amplitude modulation. If I had a second oscilloscope looking at that signal, I would see that the signal is going up and down in amplitude in correspondence to that sine wave. During the time the sine wave is positive in polarity, the amplitude out of my transmitter is going up. And during the time the sine wave going to the microphone is negative in polarity, during that half cycle, the wave coming out of the transmitter would be weaker. But that amplitude modulation on the spectrum analyzer would be this upper and lower side lobe. That's ordinary amplitude modulation, and if one of the things that Mel and I had to memorize in order to pass the FCC exam in the old days, let me drop, is that if this was a 1 kilowatt transmitter, how much audio do you need? And the answer is 500 watts. And in order to get high level amplitude modulation, half the power of the carrier must be supplied by the amplitude modulator audio output transformer, 500 watts of audio to modulate a 1 kilowatt transmitter to create that upper side lobe and the lower side lobe. When you do a little bit more study, you'd find out 250 watts of RF energy exists in that upper side lobe, and 250 watts of RF energy exists in the lower side lobe, and 1 kilowatt exists in the carrier, a total of 1,500 watts being transmitted continuously when you transmit that zone. The kilowatt is coming from the RF transmitter. The extra 500 watts is coming from the audio. Somebody said that eventually they came along and said, gee, the carrier does one thing good, and that is it tells me the signal is there, and it helps me move the signal strength meter on the receiver. But the carrier per se, in an amplitude modulated transmitter, carries no intelligence. And the upper side lobe and the lower side lobe, they're both identical to each other. They're redundancy. Let me drop. So in the very early days, somebody did a filter experiment by which they filtered out the upper side lobe, didn't pass to the antenna the lower side lobe or the carrier power, and you're still transmitting the exact same amount of intelligence, but you're using half the bandwidth on the receiver to do it, you could say the transmitter too. And so a single sideband transmitter, you could, if you want to, in theory, with modern-day filters, you could build it by just pure filter techniques. There's much more sophisticated techniques. And you wouldn't have to use a 500-watt audio amplifier. Now, once you get a little bit more smart, you generate that particular signal by filtering it way back at the low-level stages of the transmitter. You're doing everything at the milliwatt level. You do all of that filtering. You filter out the upper side lobe. You get rid of the carrier and the lower side lobe. And then you put that particular single sideband signal through all the amplification and mixing stages of your transmitter, and maybe you're doing that sideband generator at 455 KC, and you eventually mix it up to 14 megs, 14.1 megs, or 14.2 megs, and transmit it. Single sideband has got a whole lot of advantages. The total amount of power you transmitted is drastically decreased, and yet all of the intelligence is still there. The bandwidth of the receiver requirement is half the bandwidth, so you get better sensitivity out of the receiver. There's another huge advantage you get, and that is when you're doing amplitude modulation reception on a good radio, you didn't know it, but that beautiful amplitude modulated envelope coming out of the detector that gives you the audio that eventually comes out of your earphones or out of your loudspeaker, that audio that you're getting out really was a mixture of the carrier plus the upper and lower sideband being mixed together in the detector.
Comments?
At first, that doesn't sound like something you really had to have. However, when the amplitude modulated signal you're listening to gets weak, not only does the carrier get weak, but the sidebands get weak, and now that mixing process that gives you the mixture of the carrier plus the side lobes in your detector of your receiver, that process starts breaking down, and you start losing signal-to-noise ratio real fast. In the case of a single sideband receiver, it plugs the carrier back in that you locally generate. As such, you get a hell of a lot more linearity and a hell of a lot more sensitivity. The bottom line of all this, before I go over to Wesley, let me drop. The bottom line of all this is that if you start measuring the number of microvolts, how weak a signal can be, where you get good reception out of a AM transmitter and receiver, as opposed to a single sideband receiver, the answer is something like 9 decibels of advantage. You save a lot of transmit power, you occupy a lot less bandwidth on the band, the signals can be mixed together without heterodyning with each other, you get a lot more sensitivity out of the receiver. It's got advantages after advantages. The one bad part is that if you were building your own transmitter, it's a lot harder to build. There's a lot of extra stages. It requires a little bit more care. you need a lot more linearity of all of the networks. You got to work a little harder, but you get a lot of benefits when you do that work. Go ahead with your question on this one, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. Well, at first, isn't that that the selectivity is not half, but it's one-third? Although, the typical width of the sideband is 2.4 kHz out of 6. Now, 2.4 and 2.4 is 5. Not even. So, you don't have the carrier, and you don't have one sideband. That means you can tune the receiver only to one-third of the signal, approximately. Now, another thing is, the A3J in Europe was the standard for 3% of the carrier wave. And it was standard, a carrier wave of 3% is required. I would like to hear your response to that. And to Jim.
Guys are jumping ahead too far.
Yeah, let me go back to Mel. I think it was single sideband you wanted explained, and did I go too deep already is what you're saying, Mel? Go ahead.
We didn't finish the mailbag yet. We didn't even touch it. I was just getting some comments out of it. Yeah, we went too far because nobody is going to understand what you just said on the average. That's why I'm saying if we're going to talk about single sideband, we're going to take it a little bit different step by step. And I think I could give a little bit better brief answer to the subject. But can I continue now first before it gets too late with a couple of questions that's in the mailbag, Dick, over?
Yeah, why don't you give us your brief definition of single sideband, because I bet you you've had to replace to explain it quite a few of the guys you run into. Give us your brief one and or the questions in the bag. Your choice. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I'll just say what Dick alluded to. Dick, well, he gave a very good, if you know, want to really hear it in extreme detail. But I'll give it to you more on a little briefer, but a simpler maybe answer that I've gone through many times. If you fully modulate, as Dick said, an AM signal, and it was a kilowatt amplifier, all right, 100 watt amplifier, let's not talk about kilowatts, because a lot of people that I talk to never owned an amplifier. Hold on one. I want to reset this. A fully modulated AM signal has in it two-thirds of its power in what we call the carrier, and one-third of it is in its sideband. Picture this. Two-thirds carrier. Now, the sidebands actually is what we call carrying the intelligence. That's what we're transmitting, things that we got to understand. The carrier actually goes along, as Dick said, for the ride, and serves only really what we call to demodulate the signal at the receiver, which means basically, in fancy words, changes it over to something that you hear. So by eliminating the carrier and transmitting only the sideband, or just one sideband, I was going to get into, but I'm getting away. I'm not going to go into double sideband right now, but just transmitting one sideband, the power now can be used for greater advantage. Let me let it drop, and I'll say one more sentence, and then we'll let it go. However, to recover the intelligence being transmitted, because now we haven't got this carrier sitting there no more, the carrier has to be reinserted, because we got to get this back to intelligence. You want to get it, otherwise you're going to listen to blah, 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 blah. You've heard that, what they used to call Donald Duck talk, or whatever. So, to get this back, we have in the receiver, that's where we have to go to a different type of proper, what we call a detecting mode. And so this is where I'll leave it at right now. I don't want to get no further than that, but there's basically what we're dealing with now. That's why, yes, single sideband in its early days had a terrible with the old timers, especially, had they made more goddamn funny remarks about it, sloppy slide bands and the silly side bands and you name it. But because they were trying to receive it with one of the older receivers playing with the BFO, which you had to have three hands to do it to keep the signal locked in. So, all right. Now, let me let it drop, and then we'll go to at least one of the mailbags. Okay, Dick, over.
Fire away.
First of all, do you want to critique anything I say? Did I leave out anything or anything you think I should have said incorrectly? Over.
I agree with every bit of it. Two-thirds of the power is carrier and other sideband. One-third is the particular sideband. That's all you need to transmit essentially the same amount of intelligence. And now you have the ability to increase the power output of that final stage as far as the amount of intelligence is concerned, without using extra electrical power. For a bunch of reasons, you come out way ahead with a properly designed sideband system, and that's why they're so extremely popular today. I guess among the voice communication on the high-frequency ham bands, I'm going to guess that 98% or 95% of it is single sideband voice. I wonder if you agree with that, Mel, K2RIW.
And we still got the guys on 75 meters, of course, with the big AM transmitters, the old Collins broadcast transmitters, a number of them on. That's the spam guys, the Society for the Promotion of AM. And, they love that high fidelity. You know, they're on there. They sound broadcast stations. And I spoke to a few of them. And I said, gee, that's an awful big piece of equipment, that Collins rig, which weighs in at about 2.5 tons, without exaggeration. It stands almost 8 feet high. It's 48 inches wide, 48 inches deep. And I said, how the heck do you move that? Well, you need a truck with a lift and all. And they were broadcast transmitters that a lot of them were getting for nothing. And now they're on 75 meters. So that's where AM is still hanging on there. I said, yeah, but they're 5kW transmitters. Oh, we only run them in less than that. Well, way less than that. If you believe that, I think I got a bridge here in Brooklyn that's for sale at a cheap. I get it for you, a deal. Anyhow, I'm just looking here. Oh, here's a good one. In fact, I got a few of these to say. Now, what is the story with balancing an antenna? The rods on the antenna. In other words, if you look, remember the homebrew two-meter antenna the guy had for portable use? How he specifies the drilling, you've got to be ultimately care with a plumb bob to make sure the elements are all parallel. How much off parallel can you go without detrimental problems?
Funny you should ask. I did that exact experiment when I was building the so-called insulated Yagi in my backyard with what I thought was a very precise ratiometry antenna range. And you can read about what that is in the February issue, 1978 QST. I also published an article in the IEEE proceedings on that one. Not the proceedings, it was the IEEE conference that took place in New York City in, I think it was 1975 or so. Was that 75? I think it was. I'm not quite sure of the year, 74 or 75. Because my individual elements were in plastic box held with a tie wrap on top of an aluminum boom, I could rotate the elements purely vertical on a horizontal antenna to take them out of the field to find out how delicate each element was and so on. The bottom line was you can tilt the individual directors and reflectors and driven elements of a Yagi. You could probably tilt each one of them plus or minus 20 degrees randomly, and it would look ugly as all hell to your eye. Radio-wise, it would be almost the identical performance. It falls off very slowly. So when you're making all those elements precisely centered and precisely parallel to each other, you're building physical beauty that your eye can see. 95% of what I'm saying is that the RF does not see that. Go ahead and do it, because you've got pride. But if somebody hands you an antenna where the individual elements were tilted up and down 20 degrees, and you think it's going to crash and burn, don't bet on that antenna. It's going to fly. Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Okay. So in other words, if well, you put up an antenna, and sometimes, like I had here, the icing this past week, if this wasn't a real, you know, heavy constructed antenna for its size, and properly braced a number of ways, I think that the ice loading was immense here. I saw those elements really droop. I said, oh boy, I bet you something's going to snap, but once the icicle fell, they bounced back. So what I bring up now, what happens if the elements didn't bounce back? How much of a bow, let's call it a bow, can you tolerate, Dick? Over.
Boy, am I glad you asked that question. Right now, on the market, made by, used to be Symbol Technology, now the Motorola company, is an RFID reader. Hanging out in the front of this handheld RFID reader, inside of a rubber housing, is a Yagi antenna, a three-element Yagi, at 900 megacycles. That's how the antenna reads the RFID tag. And the elements of that antenna on the left side and the right side are bent down at a 45-degree angle on each side. It is almost a U-shape. When you look down the boom of that Yagi antenna, for reasons of the way the thing acts like a tripod when you lay it on a table or whatever, those elements are bent down left and right side so that they're almost a U-shaped curve, Mel, when you look at them from the front. And you're about to ask me how much retuning was required because of that bend. It probably, if I did any retuning, it was just for minor performance improvement. The antenna would have worked. If I took a flat-out antenna and I bend those elements down into a U-shaped curve where the left side and right side is bent down at a 45-degree angle at the tips, you would be very hard-pressed to measure any change in the performance. Now, when you got great big chunks of ice sticking out there and you got the capacitive loading of that, that's something else. But if those elements were bent, you would have great difficulty measuring a difference in performance. I wonder if that surprised you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, not at all. The only question I will pose is how come nobody has put out on the market a Yagi? So the saying here, well, you want to put up this 20-meter monstrosity or a 40-meter monstrosity, which gets kind of large and requires all this hardware up there. Well, let's make it a little bit more compact for you. We'll take, say, I don't know, one-third of the antenna length and make a nice bend in them and form a Yagi like that. So you look at them, you say, oh, my God, what happened to this poor guy's antenna? But you say it won't have any effect, over.
If the Schneider Natal Antenna Company made an antenna like that, its performance would be beautiful. But the psychology of human beings, because it's so different from what they have seen, for the most part, they'd be afraid to buy it. Now, you and I would run into a psychological pushback from our potential customers, but the performance would all be there. Therefore, you have the ability to make each of those elements out of lighter materials where you intentionally let them bend. You make them out of bendable materials, and they self-protect when they get great big chunks of ice, because instead of them trying to hold themselves out there stiffly parallel to the ground, they bend down and flex with the ice. They go with the flow, if you know what I mean. Psychologically, we'd have trouble selling it, Mel, but it would work like a charm. Over to you, K2LIW.
EC2QAQ with a question?
Go ahead, Glenn.
It's kind of an interesting thought that Mel brought this up, because I'm kind of thinking along the same lines, a little differently, but definitely along the same lines here. What if you had, instead of having straight out elements, if you had something that was almost C-shaped, in other words, the element would go out a certain length, bend down at 90 degrees, and then bend in at 90 degrees, but not the full length, and then just basically use like some dielectric material to come back and then make a second connection to the mast, kind of to firm it up a little bit, but in other words, it would be more like a C-shape on each side. Could you still make a Yagi that would still have horizontal polarization like that? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Or just an inverted V.
Absolutely. Whether it be an inverted V, whether it be curved into a C shape or a G shape, what you're slowly doing when you do this, Glenn and Neville, and I think I recognize Barry in there too, is that you're slowly putting in the extra metal to make it into a loop Yagi. And a loop Yagi, once you build, let me pick a number, 10 elements of loop Yagi, and you compare it to 10 elements of dipole Yagi, the performance is the same, electronically speaking. The loop Yagi has the advantage that the water gathers in the right spot, and therefore you don't get as much detuning on a damp day with a whole lot of water forming on the antenna, you know, where there's a whole lot of dew. So whether you make the individual directors into inverted Vs, non-inverted Vs, upside-down Us, downside Us, whether you build them into circles, squares, and they call it a cubical quad, triangles, or you bend each one of them so it looks like one of the initials of your name, as long as it has the right resonant frequency, the right center of resonance, and the right position on the boom, you will get all the performance out of the Yagi. And certain of those, let me drop. And certain amount of those crazy shapes that I've just described will give you extra bandwidth of the Yagi with essentially no performance degradation.
How about polarity?
Polarity is strictly a function of where the maximum current is. If I've got a cubical quad and I've got this square where the bottom horizontal bar is parallel to the ground and I feed it in the middle, I'm horizontally polarized. If I feed one of the vertical bars on the side in the middle, I'm vertically polarized. If I feed the horizontal bar on the top, I'm horizontally polarized. So where is the maximum current of the resonating element, primarily 90-some-odd percent of the time, determines the polarization?
Yeah, but instead of bending, you can simply flip it 45 degrees. Now you have a vertical polarization. That could be considered bending as well, but it works differently than horizontal.
To go to the next step on what you're just saying, Wesley, I can take any Yagi that has a boom to it, and each of the elements are any shape that you like that's your favorite shape. Triangle, square, circle, U-shape, inverted V, whatever. I can take the boom of that Yagi. As I rotate the boom around its axis, I am rotating the polarization. If I rotate it 90 degrees, my horizontal Yagi just became vertical. The Yagi you're listening to me on right now, the boom has been rotated at a 45-degree angle. In other words, I'm halfway between horizontal, halfway to vertical. I'm 3 dB down from each group of people. I can talk to the horizontal people on single sideband. I talk to the vertical people on FM repeater work, and I'm halfway between the two. So as you take the mechanical boom of the Yagi and rotate it about its longest axis, you are now rotating polarization. I think you had a further comment on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
K0J.
Glenn first and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
Actually, no, I didn't, Dick, but thanks for the explanation. You can probably pass it over to Eric. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You've got it, Eric.
Yeah, just a curious question, Dick. While you're talking about polarization, on HF, has anybody ever bothered to make a circularly polarized Yagi? I could see some advantages there.
You're absolutely right. Almost all of the high-frequency operators have been given the raw information, but somehow it didn't stick and they didn't catch on, that once that signal goes through the ionosphere, the ionosphere is a plasma, and that plasma has a simultaneous Earth magnetic field mixed into it. A plasma plus magnetic field will be polarization rotating by a phenomenon that's called Faraday rotation. So that signal that was sent to you from your buddy in London, and it bounces or goes through that ionosphere, and it rotates some number of times in polarization before it gets to you on Long Island. And so that signal that he sent that's horizontal might arrive to you almost vertical but slanted at a 45-degree angle today at this particular hour. Mel, by way of the experiments he's done by these loop receiving antennas in the shack with him, mounted with wooden structures on a tripod where he can twist it in azimuth and elevation and polarization, he has personally seen the polarization rotation that happens from day to day, and the variable is how far away is the guy, what's the state of the ionosphere, are you doing it by near vertical incident sky wave communication, are you doing it by long wave communication with the signal near the horizon. all kinds of crazy polarization is happening. Let me drop. It is my prediction that if you do enough of a study, you will discover that probably one half or more of the QSB phase you have ever seen. You think it's because the signal is hopping over you or hopping under you, if you know what I mean. Not getting there. It is my guess that 50% of the time when you see a QSB fade on the signal you're listening to on the HF band, it is a polarization fade. And if your antenna had the opposite polarization of reception, I'm guessing that roughly half of those fades would disappear. So should we be building circular polarized antennas, or should we be building polarization selectable antennas, polarization adaptable antennas? I know the answer is yes. It's just a function of how much resources and how much effort you're willing to put into it. There is a benefit that will be had. Anybody want to have a comment on this? K2RIW and the TechNet.
KC2QAQ.
I have one more question.
Glenn and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
Actually, Dick, I have experimented with it. I think you're familiar with my one antenna that will both rotate from, you know, horizontal to vertical. And I've done those experiments and measurements. Actually, those measurements are still in data, now running at least 3 years. And I did at one time actually build a 10-meter antenna that was capable at 2 feed lines so that I could drive, one vertical, one horizontal, and I could actually drive those into circular polarization. And I didn't see any advantage there, Dick. But back to you. Maybe it's the wrong band. I don't know. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, if I understand you correctly, Glenn, circular polarization, you saw no advantage. Did you have the ability to flip some switches and listen horizontal, flip some switches and listen to vertical, and compare the reception from day to day? Did you have a chance to do that? Over to you, Glenn.
Actually, I did, and that's one of the reasons why I went back to the motorized setup, so I could have vertical polarization and horizontal polarization. I was able to switch it, but that was only one band. It was just a single band antenna at, for 10 meters, relatively, because the antennas were inexpensive and wasn't all that large to make the, have horizontal and vertical at 10 meters. I don't think I'd be able to do that at 40 with four elements. So actually I went back to a five-band antenna that I have now, and I'm able to mechanically rotate it from horizontal to vertical to take advantage of that situation. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, the main missing piece of information, you gave us the raw data, but you didn't give us the punchline there, Glenn. So you've got a five-band antenna that you can mechanically rotate. You had a 10-meter antenna that you could rotate. Did you ever see the extraordinary polarization? By that I mean the guy you're talking to in London tells you he's transmitting vertical and you hear horizontal, or the guy in France tells you he's transmitting horizontal and you hear vertical. I'm calling that the extraordinary polarization. How often have you seen evidence of the extraordinary polarization of a signal on reception arriving in Massapequa in your QTH? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, that comes in two parts, and it's one of the reasons I keep on running this test longer and longer, also hoping to see that if there's an increase in the sunspot activity, whether I'll see some, because when this started, the sunspot activity was at the ultimate low, and it's starting to improve a little bit, but not seeing a tremendous difference in the data. Initially, I did think I saw that, but what was happening was I believe it was because the antenna was too low in altitude. I only had it at about somewhere around, 28 feet in the air. Now the antenna is at about, the center of the boom is about 45 feet. And since it's been there, which is now at least 3 years, everybody I speak to on horizontal sounds better on horizontal. Everybody on vertical sounds better on vertical. But that's, just still an ongoing experiment, Dick. And keep in mind, that antenna system is only good from 10 to 20 meters. That's not set up for, like 40 and 80 in those bands. But from what I've seen so far in all my experiments to about 20 meters, 14 megahertz, I haven't really seen anything fall outside of that. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And 2NB with a comment.
Okay, Barry added to the list. Were these local QSOs or long-range QSOs? In other words, because the sunspot cycle was not so favorable, I don't think they were long range. I mean, if you're talking to a guy in Pennsylvania and he's transmitting horizontal and you hear horizontal, I'm going to believe that. But But if you're talking to a guy in Japan on 20 meters, and if he's transmitting horizontal and you see nothing but horizontal, I would be amazed. Over to you for a comment on that one, Glenn.
Yeah, I have to agree with you, Dick, and I'm amazed too. And so the answer to your question is yes and yes. Yeah, long distance DX and local. If they're horizontal, they sound better on horizontal. If they're vertical, they sound better on vertical. And I've been doing this for about 3 years. Mainly, you know, most of it's really been on 20 meters. Some occasional 10, 15's been popping in and out. You know, so, you know, here again, but, you know, I've been making an effort to, every time I'm doing my DXing, to make sure that I'm asking them what the polarization of their antennas are, what their transmission power is, their location, and, you know, logging it all in. So my logbook's got a lot of extra little square boxes in there to record all this information. But generally, the best test signals, and usually if they give me a little bit more time, I go back and forth just to verify, and no, I haven't seen the anomaly yet, Vic. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm a little disappointed, Glenn. You're shooting a hole in one of my theories. However, is there a starting bias here? Do you start off with the antenna horizontal, scan the band, find the QSO, and talk to the guy so that vertical was what you're selecting inadvertently? Had you started off scanning the band vertical, the possibility exists that you would have found different amateurs in different locations favoring vertical polarization, even though they're issuing horizontal, coming to your QTA. So do you start off with the antenna horizontal and then look for vertical? Have you ever done it the other way around? Look for vertical and then find out what's there. Because when it comes to Yagis on 20 meters, I suspect the vast majority of them are horizontally polarized. So if you're starting off horizontal, you're only finding those particular signals that get to you, is a guess. Back to you for a comment on that one, Glenn. K2RIW.
Well, here again, Dick, the answer is yes and yes. I've done it where I started off scanning in horizontal, and then a couple of other times, especially where you know, the band starts getting crowded. There's a neat thing about going to vertical polarization on a really crowded day with a lot of sideband signals, that you try to listen for weak signals in vertical polarization, and you spin the antenna around, only to be disappointed that when I brought the antenna down to horizontal polarization, it's a DX station, but they come in really strong when I'm back in horizontal again. So as the sunspot cycle picks up, and you know, the performance will be different, but I haven't seen the anomaly yet, Dick. Back to you.
That's amazing, because the guys who do moon bounce, where the signal on 6 meters, 2 meters, 440 has to go through the ionosphere, boy, do they get Faraday rotation. And you seem to be not getting it on terrestrial communication. Wild. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn. Eric.
Can I just say one more comment, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Then I got a comment too, Dick.
I think the reason, Dick, is it's just as you said it. When the signal's going through the ionosphere, that's the medium in between that's actually causing the signal to be polarized as it goes through the medium. And my feeling is, and I don't know this for sure yet, but there's a possibility that the signal that's being reflected back down or refracted back down is not going through the ionosphere but bouncing back from it. So it may not be experiencing the circular polarization, but that's just a guess on my part, Dick. I'll take it, pass it back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, that HARP article, though, that was in QST last month or the month before last, did talk about the elliptical polarization and the change of ellipticity ratios that happens with HARP. But, they're not doing quite the kind of communication you are. We're going to go to Eric and then Barry in that order. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric, and what have you seen?
K2RIW, K2EJ. No, I'm having difficulty with what Glenn is saying, but because I know that, I haven't had an antenna where I've been switched between horizontal and vertical, but I've had two different antennas, which are slightly two different places, and each antenna has different characteristics, so that may not be fair. But I definitely see a difference between H and V, and especially when you ask guys what they're transmitting. But anyway, my question is, if I were to put together an antenna which I could do either left or right-hand circular polarization, because of the Faraday rotation effect, how do you think, from a transmission point of view, even though the guys have a horizontal or a vertical antenna, if I transmit circularly polarized, what kind of an advantage do you think that would bring? K2RW, K2J.
I do know that they claim that Faraday rotation is one of the kinds of gyrotropy that violates reciprocity. Now, there's a nice word for you. Okay, we're getting all words mixed up here tonight. So, in other words, when I transmit a signal from England to the United States and it gets rotated clockwise from horizontal to vertical, you would think that going from the United States back to New England, to England, it would rotate back, with the opposite way. Not necessarily. Faraday rotation, everything I've read about it tells me it violates reciprocity. You may get a clockwise twist going from east to west. You may also get a clockwise twist going from west to east, which is a sort of opposite of common sense. I don't know whether or not you're going to get a great advantage. I'm still amazed by what Glenn is telling me. What little bit of cross-polarization receptions and transmissions you have done, Eric, can you make a gut feel how often you have seen the extraordinary polarization? Extraordinary to me means he claims he's transmitting horizontal, you get him best vertical. Or he claims he's transmitting vertical and you get best horizontal. What's your guess as to how often you've seen an advantage in the extraordinary polarization? Was it 10%? Over to you, Eric.
Now, I can say about 20 years ago, I was really active on HF. I mean, I'm active now in a car, not in my house, but I can go and find my old logbooks. And I always think that, if I go through and flip through the pages, I'm going to find a lot of notation where there is that extraordinary rotation. And that was when the bands were pretty hopping, too. So. But, yeah, I don't know. That's why I guess I'm having a little difficulty with what Glenn is saying. Not to say that I don't believe him. I believe him, but it just seems odd to me because it happens more often than you think. And usually when Muff comes around, and you're getting, if you're doing communication with a terminator, and you're going to lose the band, it's especially in that last 15 minutes that you see a lot of that happening. So that brought my question about transmitting circularly polarized. I mean, really, you're transmitting all 360 degrees of polarization. You would think that, a QSB would produce itself on the receiving end. K2RW, K2J.
And as you're saying, when the MUF increases, when the maximum usable frequency gets higher, when the sunspot cycle increases and we got more ionosphere to work with, will this effect be more emphasized? I think the answer is yes. But even on a poor ionospheric condition, when at least 10 or 20 or 15 meters or 40 meters is open and you're getting a signal by way of that ionosphere, the fact that Glenn is seeing so little extraordinary polarization, I'm having a little bit of a problem with that. Now, Barry has done quite a bit of moon bounce, in which on 6 and 2, no, he's done it on 2 meters and 432, to my knowledge, maybe 1296. Guaranteed to the moon and back, he has seen a lot of Faraday rotation. I know that you've done a fair amount of HF work also, Barry, but I'm not sure you've had a dual polarized antenna of equal gain where you could do a horizontal and vertical comparison with equal antennas in the same direction. So let's see what Barry's got to say. K2, here we go, N2, moon bounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. When I bounce signals off the moon, boy, do you see a lot of rotation. You cannot figure it, and it changes from minute to minute. However, on HF, I have noticed something quite different, and I'm not even going to try to figure it out. I'm just going to let you guys figure it out. It's just an observation. What I'm noticing is signals that come from the west tend to be horizontal. This is anything over the horizon. It's got to be skipped. It's got 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 miles away. This is what I'm talking about now. Stuff that comes from the west likes to be horizontally polarized when it comes in. I have no clue why. Things that come from the east like to be vertically polarized. there's only one thing that's violating that rule, and that seems to be the Australians and the Japanese. I can't tell you why, but they tend to be either horizontal or vertical, and I don't know why. They can't make up their mind, those guys. And what I'm seeing is the Japanese and the Australians, when they come in long pass, they would tend to be horizontal. When they appear to be coming in short pass, they seem to like the vertical. Don't ask me why. I don't know why, but I have seen that over and over and over again, so I'm starting to believe it. N2MB.
In order for me to calibrate that, Barry, tell me what is the nature of your horizontal antenna and what's the nature of your vertical antenna. Could there be a little bit of difference as to the pattern they've got, the azimuth where they give the strongest signal, and so on? Tell me what was your horizontal and what was your vertical antenna during these comparisons. Over to you, Barry, K2RIW. Barry, one other thing. You could use a little bit more audio. Talk a little louder if you want to.
Yeah, I don't like raising my voice. It's been a problem. I just probably have to change microphones at some point. Because I've got the gain turned up as high as it'll go in this contraption. Anyway, two halfways in phase. This is all 75 meters, by the way. I should have qualified that. All of this is 75 meters. I've done nothing on 40, 20, 10, none of those bands. Only 75 meters. I haven't even done this on 160. But on 75 meters, I have two halfways in phase, what I've got, if you want to call it that. And of course, that's my horizontal antenna. And my vertical antenna is, you know what that is. And that's what I'm getting for results. So at most cases, I don't know why, but on some occasions to the west, I do see an improvement with the vertical. At other times, I do not. Don't know why. Can't figure it out. But 99% of the time, stuff that comes in from the west is better on the horizontal. Stuff that comes in from the east is better on the vertical. And that's what I'm seeing.
Your two horizontally polarized elements. When it comes to your vertical element, I know what it is. It's really a kind of an inverted V that's mounted sideways on the tower. But when it comes to your two-element horizontal 75-meter antenna, is this two horizontal dipoles where you flip the phase of how you feed the two so that you favor the forward or the back lobe? What are those two elements 75 meters on horizontal look like? Not many of us have got enough real estate to do that. Over to you, Barry.
Yeah, I don't have the real estate either. I've been cheating. You know that. No, this is thing, I guess it's like 300 and something feet, whatever it is. And it's just all over my neighbor's property. And it aims almost exactly north and south. So that means that its pattern is supposed to be east and west. And it is, you know, that's the pattern. So it's pretty honest, you know. Its center is about 70 feet off the ground. Its ends, both ends, well, let me think now. One end is about 25 feet off the ground, the north end. The south end, what is the south end? The south end's about 5 or maybe 10 feet off the ground. So it's kind of like, you know, a huge inverted V kind of shape.
Oh, KC2, QAQ.
Glenn, recognize, this is one single, is it almost a full-wave dipole-like thing, or it's an end-fed? You've told us how high up the ends are and how high is the center, and I think you told us it is approximately 300 feet long. Sounds like it's almost a full wave of, is that one continuous piece of wire fed at one end? Give us a couple of more words as to what that antenna is. Barry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a center-fed antenna, exactly center-fed by my tower, right at my tower. So it comes, to, you know, the two sides come together right at the top of the tower. And that's it. You know, nothing fancy.
And you're talking about the horizontally polarized antenna now. How long is each end? You told us it's almost exactly north-south. How long is the wire going north of the tower? How long is the horizontally polarized wire going south of the tower? Over to you, Barry.
Okay. 120 feet, so it would be 240 feet total.